Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 20th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Al Trost. Today's session number is 98-6, and it's titled Ethnic and Nationalist Conflict. Let's listen in.
There are two trends in the world in the 1990s, actually 1980s and 1990s, that a lot of people have commented on. One, which I'm going to talk about later in the week, is the trend toward democracies around the world. When I was going to graduate school in my first few years of teaching, there were many military governments around, and of course, the Soviet Union, which was an authoritarian regime. Many of the Eastern European countries were authoritarian regimes. And if you look down the list of leaders these days and look for colonels and majors and generals and that kind of thing, you don't find many of them at all. In fact, they're almost completely eliminated from the Western Hemisphere. Latin America, which used to have military leaders all over, now has one right now. And Africa, which was noted for this, no longer has many military leaders. Now, that doesn't mean that the democracies that are around are like the United States or like Britain, but there has been a trend away from authoritarian government toward democracy. The second trend, which is the one I wanted to talk about today, is the increase in nationalism and in ethnicity. And last week I talked a little bit about religion, especially in Northern Ireland, which I guess is a kind of specific case of the same trend, where there has been an increase in intensity of ethnic identification and nationalism. Not totally around the world. It has been, as we'll see in a few minutes, pretty much centered on several regions, but it has caused a lot of remark. Some doomsday forecasts. The best known of these, which I doubt whether a non-political scientist would look at, but one of the best known American political scientists, a man by the name of Samuel Huntington, wrote a little op-ed piece in the New York Times in 1993 about the coming clash of civilizations, is what he called it. And he was reacting to the war between the Armenians and Azeris in Russia and the breakup of Yugoslavia. And what he saw, or thought he saw, was a coming collision, not between rich and poor nations, not between different ideologies, but he thought the future would hold for the world a clash of national cultures founded on religion and language. And this was such a influential piece, or such a provocative piece, that for several years, and they're just beginning to dial down, for several years, great issues clubs, library discussion groups, and that would have panels on the clash of civilizations or the clash of cultures. And there's been a lot now, of course, to kind of refute that or attack it. But Huntington went ahead and wrote a couple of articles, and he wrote a book, which was on the New York Times bestseller list in 1995. So he's gotten a lot of, in that sense, mileage out of this. I just might mention for a minute something else about him. He was the original theorist of what's called convergence theory, that the United States and the Soviet Union were coming together in their economic, political, and cultural systems. And his forecast there generally turned out to be right. So people listened to him. He's not a kook. He's not a strange voice by any means. And so that's one of the reasons that this article was much attended to by at least influential opinion, elite opinion. So I want to talk a little bit about that today, and then I want to get around, as I was not able to do last Saturday on immigration and refugees, a little bit more to what we can do about this, both our own national political system and also individuals. To begin with, the present international system is based upon states. State has a different meaning in the United States. We mean in Washington, Indiana, Minnesota, but in international relations, states are entities with land, people, sovereignty, and government. And there are about 180 of these now recognized by the United Nations. Not all of them are members. Switzerland is still not a member of the United Nations, but there are about 180. Sometimes when you hear people talking, and this happens in my own area too, in international relations and political science, people will slip into the idea of the nation state. The idea that this formal entity with some of these boundaries, I've got a map of Africa up here, and those boundaries define states, that they overlap with nations. Nations are communities of people who feel together. That's, you don't need to get any more elaborate than that on an afternoon like this. But usually the feeling of togetherness is based on a common history or a common story, a common language, sometimes a common religion, which may even reinforce the language. One of the reasons I put Africa up, and one of the reasons I handed this other map around, is that Africa is a good example of a place where there are some 50 states. But if nation means people who have a common story and a common language, this is more what the map of Africa should look like. Actually, hundreds of distinct peoples, distinct cultures, distinct languages. And so, if nationalism would go to its full extent, and everybody that had a common history, language, the kind of best judgment here is that there would be about 5,000 nation states. If every nation got self-determination in the sense of having a state. And that's far more than would be viable. I mean, already, once I just spent $75 extra on the train in Europe and went to Liechtenstein, see what a little state, toy state was like. And Liechtenstein's a very pretty place. It's in a valley. Austria's on one side, Switzerland's on the other. But it could not exist if it didn't have almost the same economy, was in a kind of customs union with Switzerland, and a lot of free trade agreements with Austria. I mean, it's just, it's not viable to have a place with a couple thousand people living in it and be able to sustain itself free of any kind of network of links, governmental and economic, to another state. So 5,000 would, I mean, that would just be impossible. But then the question for the world, I suppose, and people who want to regulate things is, how far do you let this go? Now again, for 25 years from the time that the map of Africa materialized here, pretty much all of this was set in the early 1970s. African independence pretty much is between 1956 and 1974. So the map of Africa looked like that and has not changed very much at all since 1974. And in fact, in the world generally, the number of nation states, pretty much froze in that period. But since the beginning of this decade of the 1990s, we've had several places in the world where, again, of the claim for self-determination of peoples has been heard very strongly, and in fact, in several of those areas, the nations have been able to gain statehood from themselves and be recognized in that claim to statehood. The two obvious places are the former Yugoslavia and the former Soviet Union. And the former Soviet Union has kind of broken apart from one nation state now into 15. And of course, Yugoslavia has been in front of us in the news. If we have a little bit of time, and there isn't much discussion, I might come back and just talk a little bit more about Yugoslavia as kind of a case study of how this dynamic has worked in recent times. Another place where this has happened, of course, has been in the Middle East, but there, a kind of different kind of foundation for nationalism is going on. Here, common language is not a factor, right, because practically all of the Middle East speaks Arabic. But we have the claim of the Palestinian people for part or all of what is now Israel and some of the surrounding territory. And that claim for nation statehood has come fairly close to fruition. I mean, it's not an accomplished fact by any means. There was a team of people who talked about Palestine last week and made us plenty much aware of the fact that Palestine still had a little bit of ways to go before it was a state and was viable as a state. But certainly in my lifetime, in my time of studying international relations and comparative politics, there's been more progress made in the 90s on the question of Palestinian statehood than at any previous time. The other place, of course, is and where there's always a kind of turmoil and a dynamic for creation of new states is Africa. The tumult in Central Africa over the last 4 or 5 years in Rwanda and Burundi, which are already tiny little states, but they are seemingly from the outside hopelessly divided between Tutsis and Hutus. And you know, what do you do in that kind of situation? There certainly is a lot of pressure because those people are very much fearful of one another to create some new nation states there. And so Africa is a problem primarily because of this disparity again between that map and this map. There are a few African states where there is only one predominant culture, but this gets almost to overwhelming proportions. For instance, in the case of Tanzania, some of us know that a bit because the Lutheran Church has a fairly fertile mission field here and a lot of connections to Tanzania. And there are about 125 different languages spoken there, 125 different cultures. And Tanzania is right now one of the poorest countries in the world. So, you know, if you divide that up even more, you can see what the problem would be. Well, having said that, I'd like to talk a little bit now about the present trends in the foundation for nationalism. What are the claims like, and what is the American response to these, and the world's response, for that matter? In the 17th century, primarily, this is the period, the 1600s, when the 30 Years' War ended and the Peace of Westphalia was made, this was a signal to several places in Europe that we today recognize as nation states to build, first of all, a state, and then around the state, a nation. Two of the best examples of this would be France and the United Kingdom. they were, despite the fact that today we see a kind of homogeneous nation state, at that point they were not. And there was no feeling, of course, at this date in history of kind of common feeling or we-ness. And so at the same time the state was being created, the nation had to be created out of this common story, common identity, common language. I think you know, the vestiges of this are clear in the case of the United Kingdom, where we still have some Scottish nationalism, right, some Welsh nationalism. We're seeing the effects of Irish nationalism and Ulster nationalism in the news over the last week or so. That kind of signals that the British were, while they created a state, were not completely successful in creating one nation. The other pattern of creating a nation is the one set in the 19th century, where the nation existed already in terms of a common language, a common history. And the task was to create a state around the nation. And the two big examples of that are Germany and Italy, which, if you would look at a map from, for just we were talking about the 17th century, you'd see all kinds of little political units in those countries. And so the struggle was to create a state around an existing nation. Africa more resembles the French and British situation in that they have to create a nation along with creating a state. And they are not very far down the road on this, as we meet here this afternoon. Certainly the common nation hasn't come very far since independence in most African countries. And again, I don't want to do too much with political science here, but one of the big, again, kind of areas of interest in political science is that after an initial kind of enthusiasm about the chance of third world countries to really kind of make it economically, to get their people together and that to get their economy running and to get their authority accepted throughout the country, there's now a good deal of skepticism about what kind of authority exists in many of these African countries. A fairly influential book, an article came out in the 1980s by Joel Migdal, which talked a lot about how the societies here were stronger than the state, and that if you wanted to do business in these countries, you had to do business with the traditional authority structures in the villages, with village headmen, for instance, or with people practicing a kind of primitive kind of medicine or a natural kind of medicine. They were the authority figures, and the authority of the state existed only in the capital city, where you'd see these jeep loads of soldiers running around. They could often make people do things, but once you got out of the capital city, not so. Even in Mexico, you see something like this, even to this day. Local caudillos were more of a factor, of course, in the 19th century and early 20th century, but there's still a good deal of localism in Mexico, and if, again, you get things done and do business, you're probably better off not going through the national government in Mexico City, but going through, in fact, more traditional societal structures in the various Mexican states. So what the Africans are trying to do, what many other third world countries are trying to do, is to construct a state and a nation at the same time. And this is a major, major struggle. We know some of the features of this, that there's a good deal of poverty there to start with, a good deal of a history of oppression, there are a lot of obstacles to overcome, which makes us all the more anxious then, I guess, when we see an explosion of new nation states. For instance, in the former Yugoslavia, where you had one nation before, not really a rich nation, but I should say a state in this case again, because you have five nations here. But you had a state, and now that's broken apart into four at the present time, and it looks like Kosovo might break apart even more from the former Yugoslavia. So, now, for the world, for the international system, and especially for the United States, as we look at ethnic identification and nationalism, something like the Huntington article provokes us, I think, to take a very negative opinion toward this, but I think we would all have to recognize that ethnic identity and nationalism serve some good purposes. It gives people a feeling of belonging, and especially the kind of general mood in post-industrial and the post-industrial countries and the world influenced by post-industrialism is a certain feeling of disconnectedness, alienation, of enemy. And to identify with a religion and with a language group gives people a sense of being together. It also, in a more material sense, gives them some resources. You can call upon your group to help you. Because my main interest is in Ireland, I get the Irish American newspapers. And I mean, they're loaded, as a lot of ethnic newspapers are, with places you can go for, first of all, help if you need a kind of fast road to getting welfare services or educational services. It will always have a bunch of addresses, people, centers, Irish American cultural centers, and so forth in the cities. But they also have a full list of people who provide services for hire, for pay. And the plea always at the top of the page is, you know, contact Irish Americans if you got carpentry to be done, or you want to sell your house, or you want to travel to another country, you know, contact this O.J. Donnelly and Sons real estate firm. And so it does, and not that the Irish are suffering that much in the United States, but it is an example, again, of construction of a kind of self-help network. So we don't want to, I think, you may have different feelings about this, kind of stamp out nationalism and ethnic identity entirely. It's the international system seems to have a kind of self-correcting mechanism so that when a period of stability seems to be reached, there is a good deal of resistance to altering the system, and this happens with the creation of new nation states as well. We saw it happening after the initial burst of creation of new countries, new states in Africa, where the big case here is Nigeria, where you have four or five major ethnic groups or peoples, and after independence, of 4 or 5 years, the different peoples began to claim self-determination for themselves. The major example of this are the Igbo people, who some of you may remember the nation state or the claim to be a nation state of Biafra in the middle 1960s. And it's interesting that many of the world's powers linked up with Nigeria to keep Nigeria whole, including, although it wasn't quite as strong-armed or strong-handed in this as Britain or the Soviet Union, our weight, our pressure was still put behind Nigeria to keep the country together, even though the Igbos, and we have an Igbo man in the village this week, even though the Igbos are the Christianized part of Nigeria and were the ones probably most easily assimilated to British rule when Nigeria was part of the British Empire. So the major powers get a bit disturbed when this happens. So from a kind of national security point of view or security point of view, changes in number of nation states is usually hard to talk the powers that be into. There are a lot of other kind of good reasons why we have to regulate of nationalism. I mean, the Yugoslavia, again, is a good case here where this can reach a limit where we have this phenomenon of ethnic cleansing or genocide, where one people here try to stabilize their claim to nationhood by eliminating people from another group. This didn't always result in killing in the former Yugoslavia, but it resulted in, and you remember the images from the last couple of years, Croatians being deported from Serbian-held areas, Muslims being deported from Serbian-held or Croatian-held areas, and actually everyone in Yugoslavia was guilty of this kind of thing, trying to construct a nation with kind of definable boundaries. One of the problems in Yugoslavia is that the peoples aren't nicely mixed. This is a hard map to tack up on the board, and I think most of you have seen things like this anyway, but I can pass this around. This is a map of the kind of location of the various ethnic groups, and of course the big one here is Bosnia, right, where even more than is on this map, the Croatians, Muslims, and Serbs are mixed together. And so over the last couple of years, what's been happening, the reason the UN initially sent in a force and now NATO, is to try to keep that ethnic cleansing, the realtering of where the peoples live from going any farther down the road. So, maybe I should just... So that definitely a kind of humanitarian concern here that we can't let nationalism get to this stage. Let me talk a little bit about the resources that are available or what can be done about nationalism. I should say right from the beginning, as I did with immigration and refugees, not a lot. The picture is not real optimistic, but a couple of things that have been done in other countries, and we see movement toward this, especially in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia. One is to meet the claim for nationhood halfway or a third of the way by giving more autonomy to the different claims to nationhood, construction of a federal system or confederal system where maybe the Croatian national unit or the Ukrainian national unit is stronger than you may remember the Commonwealth of states in the former Soviet Union, so that the claims for a separate political entity are somewhat realized. At the same time, you guarantee economic links and a kind of network of political help networks. So that's one thing that can be done, and that has worked in different places. Probably the two best examples are Switzerland and Belgium, where there still is, you know, some tension, especially in Belgium. But it's interesting, that's my wife's family lived in Geneva. My father-in-law worked for the Lutheran World Federation for a while, and especially when you meet Swiss outside of Switzerland and you ask them what they are, they say Swiss. Often even in Switzerland, you know, the identity is Swiss, even though, you know, there are several different, again, cultures here, several different stories, several different languages. It is possible to tamper around with the constitutional arrangement and to give Germans and this German Swiss and French Swiss and Italian Swiss some autonomy, some feeling that their claims to nationhood are recognized. At the same time, you preserve the viable-sized nation-state. Of course, Belgium is the other place this is done. Belgians, though, if you ask them what they are inside Belgium, they won't say Belgian. They will say they're Walloons or Flemons. If you ask them outside, where people often confuse them with the Dutch, that is, the Flemish people speak a language very similar to the Dutch, and they, of course, the people in southern and western Belgium speak French. They don't want to be confused with the French, and they don't want to be confused with the Dutch. So if you ask a Belgian in England or in Germany, what are you? They'll say, you know, quite proudly, we're Belgian. I suppose a kind of ridiculous example of this is Hercule Poirot. If you watch Mystery on PBS, and he's always strong here, the claim that he is a Belgian, even though people often confuse him with a Frenchman. So these are two examples of this kind of thing. Another possibility is to use machinery from the United Nations to try to stabilize the situation, to try to stop at least the more offensive anti-humanitarian practices, and try to get parties talking. This, of course, was what we've tried in Somalia and tried in Yugoslavia. Those happen to be two failures of sorts. The problem is that the United Nations does not have the power or the financial support to do that kind of thing. It's one of the first things thought about these days. I have been doing a little project myself on Central Africa, on Rwanda and Burundi, and going back over the newspapers following this story from its at least recent beginning. It's been there for a long time, but you know, as soon as there was evidence of genocide, they began to discover these mass graves. There was a call for the United Nations to send in a peacekeeping force. And this often is the response, certainly was the response in Yugoslavia. It was called for in the problems in between Azerbaijan and Armenia. But the UN is very limited here because, first of all, this whole function, this whole idea of using military force to separate peoples, and even more than that, maybe to even start some kind of peace talks, is not backed up by material in the UN charter, machinery in the UN charter. The UN was supposed to be initially a collective security operation where the whole world could agree that yes, this state, Serbia, for instance, is an aggressor, and then take definitive action against Serbia. But as you know, the UN really has only done this probably twice, once in the Korean War. And there, it's debatable whether that was an American action or a United Nations action. And the other place was the Persian Gulf. Again, more clearly, I think, an American action in that case, even though other troops participated. So they, what's described in the Charter of the United Nations and what's anticipated in the United Nations is a very different kind of thing than this peacekeeping. So. For instance, to use Yugoslavia as an example of how this wasn't very effective, we were so disturbed, the world was so disturbed that this genocide and ethnic cleansing was going on that we interjected a so-called peacekeeping force into Yugoslavia to separate primarily Bosnian Muslims from Bosnian Serbs, from Bosnian Croats. And when Serbia especially challenged that, the United Nations forces were not armed well enough to stop the Serbs. So we had the years 1995 and 96, especially here, where the Serbs just simply you know, would kind of ignore the United Nations. Commanders would call for air support, but the very presence of the UN force and the need for the United Nations to work by the principle of unanimity meant that almost nothing could be done. And that's one of the reasons why the peacekeeping function was shifted from the United Nations to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Is that there, the United States and Britain and France and Germany, if they agree among themselves, can get more things done than trying to depend upon the five permanent members of the United Nations. So that is a possibility. And of course, the United Nations has always been good for at least having people who are diplomats come in contact with one another and talk things out. That doesn't stop the people doing the violence on the ground, however, and you know, that's a, there's a long step between a Serbian Muslim and a let's say the Yugoslavian diplomats talking to one another in the United Nations corridors and having anything meaningful happen on the ground. But that is something that we've depended more and more on, and often it does stop the most explicit kinds of violence and horrific activity. And then something that's at least possible in small-scale societies, and when I was talking about Northern Ireland last week, at the beginning of last week, I didn't really get around to this. But it is possible for forums to be set up for people to meet at the level of the common ordinary person from one community to another. I haven't been to Yugoslavia, so I can't say whether that's a viable alternative there. But certainly in Northern Ireland, it has worked to a certain extent. Now, it didn't stop the violence last week against the three children. It's not going to stop the standoff in Dumcree. It's not going to make all the Protestants reconcile to a future of a Catholic United Ireland. But it does, I think, again, at one level, save a number of lives and burnt buildings and terrorized people. There are in Northern Ireland a number of reconciliation communities, mostly sponsored by churches, that bring people together, usually without a political agenda. It gets them together much like this community here. There's one, especially Corrie Mila, it's called, up on the northern coast of Northern Ireland, that brings families, children together. They have a Narnia, it's not called that, but that kind of thing. The children, the Protestant and Catholic children, play together during the day. The parents attend workshops, information sessions. The churches are able to bring in people who work for the government so they can tell them how to apply for welfare, how to find better schools and that for their children. So there are a number of these things that go on. Most of them, again, are small scale. I think Corrie Mila's capacity is about the same as Holden Village's. It's got a few less buildings. Stays aren't as lengthy as they are here, but that's the largest one, the largest reconciliation center. The rest of them are a good deal smaller than that. Now, again, there has to be, and I think there are some things going for Northern Ireland that are not going for Yugoslavia. But this is another possibility. And then I think, you know, where it's very clear that a situation cannot continue, a situation of genocide and ethnic cleansing, I think Americans can, and people of other democracies can bring pressure on their government to withhold support from any of the warring parties. Again, you know, there's always a conflicting interest in this. It's, in the Yugoslavian thing, for instance, again, the United States was, the government was evaluating things other than just the level of violence. It was evaluating stability in the region. It was trying to hold down Serbian chauvinism. It was trying to maintain what was an improving relationship with the Soviet Union. So all of these things are going on at the same time. I think that it is always possible for people to try to understand the situation and to try to get our government to act in such a way that it will not inflame the situation anymore. It's already done. I think I'll stop there. We still have about 20 minutes to see what you want to talk about, or what kinds of ideas you have or questions you have. Last week I did religion and politics and specific countries. Most people didn't know much about them, so there were a lot of informational questions. This week I'm trying to focus on some global issues and concerns, and so it's a little more, I suppose, amorphous kind of topic, or too cosmic, maybe too global.
Question I thought I've had recently, wondering, watching the European Union come together in sort of an economic forum, and sort of the relationship between that and the federal model that you were describing earlier, and wondering whether over time we will see, and if that's sort of a new model potentially for, I mean, because really what you're doing is juxtaposing nation and state and saying how can these things coexist. I wonder, especially, I mean, it's very early to tell with the European Union how that will play through, but that does at least structure, offer the potential for some kind of economic structure that sort of superimposes over a more nation or other kind of structure.
Yes, certainly the European Union is a very good model of a way to deal with this. It's taking place, of course, in a very developed part of the world, a part of the world that, from Huntington's point of view, again, that shares a kind of common culture.
A Christian
culture. Languages are pretty much related to one another. So a horror with war, having fought two general wars, things pushing that situation. But certainly, over the last 30 years, there have been moments of real optimism about this alternative, is usually called regionalism. To move in that direction, regional identities. But again, Huntington, I think, is a little worried about this, in that one can do this, for instance, among Islamic states, and you may come up with, by encouraging some kind of unity and by encouraging the end to nationalism, you may construct a power that eventually threatens the United States. And so, like everything else, there are evils and goods to balance off here. But it's certainly the case of the European Union, former European Community Common Market, that certainly is a way to go. You can talk about also going the other way. That is, if you can develop a better international system that encompasses the whole world, one might be able, under those circumstances, to create something like counties around the world that would have a relationship beyond the relationship with their own nation state. They would have a relationship with, let's say, the United Nations, and get a hearing in the United Nations. So, the Albanians and Kosovo might have another way to go here, because probably one would despair of trying to put Yugoslavia back together again. This is something that a lot of people hold out hope for instance, in Northern Ireland, because Ireland and the United Kingdom are both members of the European Union. They are forced into a kind of networking or cooperation that they ordinarily would not probably have done for a long time. Yes. And to incorporate a marginalized area like Yugoslavia might have some effect that would be
somewhere. What about in Africa? Are there any kind of regional movements?
There have been, they have not really worked very well. Most of these were tried right after independence,
when people were ready.
Yes, but there was such a kind of collision here of backgrounds and cultures. You had people whose experience had been with French government, people whose experience had been with British government, and each of those powers ran their empires, their colonies differently, and so it made it very difficult again for people who had lived in French colonies to get used to the British way of governing. The British in Africa tended to decentralize government, they handed authority back over to the traditional authorities again, you know, so ethnic group kings and chiefs. The French tended to bring their own people in and run it like they ran France. And so it was very difficult to overcome that. Plus, again, the distrusting one another, disliking one another. Not all of bad nationalism results from, though, big histories of conflict like Yugoslavia, where you've had 500 years of conflict between Orthodox Christian Serbians and, let's say, Catholic Croatians. Some of this nationalism arises, for instance, contemporary German nationalism arises from people who normally had not interacted with them, the guest workers, coming and encountering Germans in their own country, which has caused a resurgence of nationalism. One other method that I could mention that was tried by the United States, because we're state of many nations, many peoples, was to assimilate people into kind of an American identity, an American way of life. We've moved away from that, haven't we? It's now kind of a nation of many nations. Nationalism around the world affects that in our country. For instance, the whole movement toward a kind of black identity and African, back to Africa movement among American blacks was largely a response to independence in Africa. And so now the thinking seems to be, I mean, the government's policy is not one of assimilation, but of empowering different groups as long as there finally is an allegiance to the United States, some agreement to cooperate with other groups. But we have kind of moved away from the assimilation thing ourselves, because that was not necessarily creating a just society or an equal society, so going in a different direction.
Can you talk about Germany? It may not be related to what we've been focusing on, but the reuniting of East and West, and what you see as the success there. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Germans have accepted a reunified nation. Everybody knows that that's the future. There is still, I was in Germany in March, and there still is a good deal of resentment by the West Germans of the East Germans. When the wall came down, a lot of people expected millions of people to move from East Germany to West Germany. That kind of migration has not taken place. I think about 500,000 people have permanently changed their homes from the East to the West. Now, there are a lot more people working there, but they've kept their homes. Many of the family members are still living in what was the German Democratic Republic. But it was interesting, you see graffiti on the walls that says basically send the Easterners back, the Osties back. From the West German point of view, they're a load on the state. They're the ones, so the stereotype goes, that are claiming the welfare benefits. Communism made them soft and lazy. And they're not working as hard as the West Germans. That's the kind of perception of many West Germans toward the Easterners. So there's a lot that's got to be done there. And it doesn't make it easier in Germany right now that they are trying to adjust to the single currency. The Germans are very anxious about that. The value of the Deutschmark has fallen over the last 18 months, and this was supposed to be the anchor, the stable element in the new European currency unit. And Germany's now worried whether by the end of this year it's going to make all of the requirements that it itself had set up in terms of percentage of debt over against gross national product and that kind of thing. So the Germans are anxious anyway now. They got a major change coming up with the relationship with other European Union nations, and then in addition to that, they have the problem of what was a much less developed state now joining them, and demands in the East for equity, for jobs, for better housing. And then to handle all of that at the same time has caused the Germans a lot of angst, a lot of anxiety. I don't think, again, as I said when I started, I think this is the future of Germany. I mean, there's no way that they'll go back to creating another nation here. Germany's always had regional problems because, again, it was a state that was forced together. So the Bavarians, for instance, have always been, in their own minds, a kind of separate people. They have a different political value system. They're very conservative. They're very Catholic, in contrast to the rest of Germany, more traditional family values in Bavaria. And it's not a new problem for the Germans, but I think this, I mean, Italy's much the same way, where you've had the big difference between northern and southern Italy. Northerners in Italy, again, kind of resent the backward ways, the kind of easygoing lifestyle of the southerners. And the southerners have always migrated north looking for a better life, and they then become the welfare clients and cause a lot of resentment in northern Italy. So I think that this is what happens when you kind of force statehood, as happened in Germany and in Italy's case. But one of the ways this is manifested, this anxiety, of course, is in support for extremist movements. And I don't know that neo-Nazism, nationalism is any stronger than it was 10 years ago, but you still see a lot of that. There are still parades through the streets, anti-immigration slogans, that kind of thing.
In many instances, these ethnic rivalries are, maybe all instances, they are historically rooted, and they go back many, many centuries. And the passions and the hatreds where they exist, are almost irreversible because of that. There's no quick fix to them. You can't send a UN reconciliation team and hope to overcome 9 centuries of fighting. And I'm just very pessimistic about what any outside organization such as the UN can do, otherwise, other than just kind of keep the lid on them and somehow develop a structure in which some sanity and rationality can prevail above and beyond the forces that represent the rationality, let's say, have a chance over against those who have the historic passions going for them. I don't really know how you overcome that. I mean, the UN is so helpless in this kind of a situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think the UN represents anything more than lowering the temperature a little bit on the conflict. I mean, there's no way that it's going to do much more than that. I do think that there's probably a place for still the strong powers, the great powers, to do as they did after the First World War and the Second World War, kind of impose a constitutional settlement on people and try to encourage its working out. But I think that you know, at the whole, the macro level, the system level, that's about as much as we can do from the outside in that kind of situation. Yes, you're right. Although, again, you know, this isn't on a kind of level of intensity with the Yugoslavian thing, but, you know, the Turkish guest workers in Germany are, although one could say that the Ottoman Turks were at Germany's gate, you know, several hundred years ago, so maybe this isn't a new encounter.
But the Germans have had a few problems since the Turks.
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah. One of the things about Yugoslavia that is interesting is that, I mean, there's a common language there. The Serbs, the Croatians, the Montenegrins, the Muslims in Serbia all speak the same language. And the Muslims and the Christians in Serbia are really the same people, but again, kind of an accident. Not an accident, but a feature of history here, the Ottoman invasion, the Turkish invasion. When this was a hot topic, people, political science and history, were asked to do a lot of Rotary Club, Kiwanis Club talks. And one of the things that I found out there is that a lot of the Muslims actually trace their lineage back to an aberrant Christian community in Yugoslavia that rejected the symbols of Eastern and Western Christianity, and they were kind of isolated. And when the Turks came in, they decided that their future was with the Ottoman Turks and with the Muslims. And so many of the people in that are called Muslims today were Christians 300 or 400 years ago. So, you know, there's not even that much difference in Yugoslavia in a way. But again, it's rooted in history, and the a lot of 19th century history figures in here too. And the settlement of the First World War forcing these countries together in the new Yugoslavia.
How do you see some of this playing out in the U.S.? I mean, I was just thinking about some of the language demands. You know, certainly it's sort of really burgeoning Spanish, and Spanish, the use of Spanish even officially in communities. It pulled a lot of pressure even internally in the U.S. to at least acknowledge, if not by sovereignty, at least acknowledge more diversity than there has been.
Well, I think that's about the only way we can do it now, I think, because before the waves of immigration that came to the United States were, again, groups that were relatively easy to assimilate. But now we have people of, you know, coming from, in Huntington's terms, again, completely different cultures. And from Asia, for instance, and very difficult to assimilate those people in the way that we used to think possible, so that, this may mean, you know, further decentralization. This seems to be what was going on, at least during the Republicans, and President Clinton gave some lip service to this, that, you know, the federal government had to back up a bit and give more autonomy to localities and the states, let them be responsive to these communities, and hope that the integration comes when elites in Washington negotiate and bargain with one another. That we shouldn't try to get this kind of ultimate and lasting loyalty to the United States of America as the definitive community from all of these people. So I don't know. I don't think it's, I mean, I'm not much worried myself about this working out, but more a vague feeling than anything that I've really thought through.
Well, sometimes don't realize, though, that we do have within our own nation a certain movement. I happen to come from Hawaii, which has two official languages, both Hawaiian and English. And we are the only state that has its own language, Hawaiian. We also have a sovereignty movement. Many of the people want to be completely independent of the United States. Many of them want to have more of a the intermediate system. But I mean, it isn't just in some of the countries of the world, but we do have such movements within our own country that generally are based, again, on ethnicity.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or in tiny little cases on ideology, like the militias in Idaho and Montana wanting to declare their own little...
Well, supposedly, though, they're defending. Supposedly, they're defending the real constitution.
Yes, right.
The true Americans.
That's right.
Well, thank you for coming on a nice Holden Village afternoon.
Well,